cliffs, some rushing down to the dam of a man-made lake, all of them circling back to the town center with labyrinthine flourishes that never failed to take my breath away. In mythology, I'd read about Ariadne, how she used red string to guide Theseus free of the Minotaur's furry grasp. Yet in this town, it seemed every path led back to the same dilapidated strip mall. In this town, it seemed the Minotaur would always find you. I'd already learned that there were no simple, straight roads out of town. The night I'd been outed, after my father gave me his ultimatum, I ran a few internet searches in my bedroom, straining the whole time to listen for my parents' footsteps in the hallway outside. I ran an online credit check and found that I had almost no credit to my name. I queried message boards on how to file for independence, but all of the answers seemed much too complicated. There were too many forms to fill out, too many signatures, too much thought required. As it stood, my parents were paying for more than half of my education, and if I couldn't change who I was, they were going to take this away from me. Yet the thought of abandoning my parents, of joining a community of gay-friendly people, and somehow continuing life without them, this seemed even worse than suicide. Cutting away my roots and the people I loved would transform me into a shell of the person I once was, an automaton stripped of all its gears. I somehow knew that leaving my family behind would destroy whatever love I hadn't already thrown aside to make room for shame. During the past month at college, literature professors who had sensed something of my family situation took pains to invite me to their dinner parties, ushering me into their discussions of critical theory, of Foucault and third-wave feminism, of the neocons who were busy robbing the country blind. Around this time, President Bush felt inspired by God to find WMDs in Iraq, and it seemed every dinner I attended featured a heavy dose of fundamentalist bashing. My new friends, Charles and Dominique, two of the few black students at our college, were constantly teasing me about how the Baptists had all been slave owners, how my family tree was full of white supremacists. "Your family used the Bible to keep our folks down," Charles said. "They probably beat us with all those Bibles they had lying around," Dominique added. The thought of what King Cotton had done to Charles and Dominique's ancestors made me suddenly shameful of my family. One moment I was terrified that my ancestors were all sitting up in heaven and judging my same-sex attractions, and the next I would judge them for what I assumed they'd done to black bodies. Less than a year later at LIA, I would wonder why our genogram keys didn't feature the sins of slavery or racism, why it seemed so much of history had been left out. Sitting there in the midst of my professor's intelligent conversations, I had felt like both an imposter and a traitor. I smiled at the appropriate moments, made droll comments about my upbringing, mocked the politics of almost everyone in my hometown. Yet it was also true that coming home often made me feel, if not proud of my heritage, then at least grateful for its familiarity. At home, I was able to say an elegant prayer, offer a bit of wisdom about God's grace, recite scripture at the appropriate moment, offer my best smile. At home, it was a relief to slip back into a world that was known, to deal in platitudes, quiet my mind. With each pilgrimage to and from home, the boundaries between the two territories grew weaker, and I grew more terrified of what would happen once I finally lost my footing. Both sides seemed to suggest the same efficient solution. Cut ties. Either abandon what you've known your entire life and your family, or abandon what you're learning about life and new ideas. I began to see strong evidence in favor of the latter, though I didn't think it would be easy to forget the sense of wonder I'd experienced in my Western lit class while learning about what the church referred to as a sinful pagan past. There had been a moment in the middle of our class discussion of the Odyssey, Odysseus stopping up his ears to muffle the siren call, when I sat up in my desk, unplugged my own ears, raised my hand, and asked to be untied from the mast. "It never gets old, does it?" my father said. The truck had slipped beneath a canopy of yellowing trees. "God's creation?" "No," I said, pressing my hand to the glass, watching the pale leaves slide through the gaps between my fingers. "We'll get through this," he said. "I've talked with Brother Stevens. He has some ideas." Brother Stevens was the pastor of our church. After my father decided to become a preacher, the two of them grew very close, spending most of their free hours together on the paisley-patterned chairs in Brother Stevens's church office. Though my father had yet to be ordained as an official preacher, he often substituted for Brother Stevens when the man was sick. I hadn't seen much of Brother Stevens since moving to college, and I was happier for it. There was something about his small, close-set eyes that made me nervous. In high school, when I ran the church projector for him on Sunday mornings, I had felt as though he were directing every word of his condemnation against me, as though I were the Satan he warned us about, sitting up in my mounted booth above the rest of the congregation, mocking God with my fantasies of the straight-backed Brewer twins who sat in the front row. During sermons, he would sometimes speak of the prodigal daughter who continually made his life more complicated, her drug overdoses, her live-in boyfriends, her casual use of the Lord's name in vain, her frequent incarceration. She was the typical preacher's kid gone wild. As a result, Brother Stevens had developed a policy of tough love. He had left his daughter to fend for herself numerous times, though he'd often agreed to help foot the bill for rehab. I knew that whatever advice he had to offer my father would be harsh. I had a hunch that inviting me to the jail ministry had been his idea, part of a scared straight routine that the church employed when, for example, it invited ex-drug addicts to recount their horror stories and long-winded testimonies that took up the majority of the service, most of our congregants leaving teary-eyed and feeling lucky to be alive in their own skin as they walked out the front door. Despite my hunch, I still believed Brother Stevens might be right. A strict, dark, new perspective might be exactly what I needed. We rolled to a stop in front of the main highway, and my father switched on his blinker. "Is the difference between what's natural and what's not natural?" he said, the brakes hissing beneath us. "You've always been a good Christian, but you've somehow gotten the two mixed up. We'll get you to the right counselor." I hadn't felt truly natural since junior high, when I first saw my handsome neighbor walking his dog down the street, a moment that had me begging secretly for a leash. "I don't want to talk about it," I said. "Your friend, what's-his-name, didn't have a problem talking about it." Friend. The word sounded cavalier, without a trace of irony, landing smugly between the blinkers ticking like a hard fact. It made me want to jerk the wheel in the wrong direction, slam the gas pedal to the plastic floorboard, drive us into the side of the nearest building. "He's probably told half the town by now," my father continued. I had been avoiding public places for this very reason. David didn't live too far from our town, and odds were he'd already told several mutual friends I was gay in an effort to save face. I'd found out from one such mutual friend that he was on academic probation, that no one had seen him on campus for a month, that it was likely he'd move back in with his parents. He'd probably exaggerated facts, made it sound like I was the pedophile. He'd probably told people I had tried to sleep with him. My roommate Sam had already decided to move out of our room. I was now rooming with my friend Charles, and I suspected that the reason for Sam's sudden departure was that he'd heard these rumors. There was nothing to do now but hide, wait for the current to calm, and try to find a cure. "I don't care what he tells people," I said. "He's not a Christian." "I thought he went to church," my father said, pulling onto the highway. "I thought you said he was a good kid." "Yeah, a Pentecostal church," I said, remembering the old post office with its rusted metal beams and its brightly lit stage, its motor oil. "It's not the same." The words came out of my mouth without my permission. Blaming, self-righteous in nature, they felt natural, marching into place somewhere between a truth and a lie, powered almost exclusively by rage. They lent themselves to a sense of conviction, of purpose. They snapped everything around us into focus. The double yellow lines, the strip malls along the sides of the road, the faces looking out from smudged windows. They carried with them the tone and lazy dinner party logic of some of my professors, but with very little of the same content. Months later, when first meeting the LIA staff, I would instantly recognize these hybrid words as my own, though I wouldn't know the full extent of their power until they were used against me. "They speak in tongues and use anointing oil," I said. "It's disgusting." "Judge not," my father said, the blinker snapping back into place as he turned the wheel. "Lest ye be judged." "Thou shalt not bear false witness," I said. More than a decade of Sunday school lessons, and I could recite scripture almost as well as my father. use it just as easily to justify my means. "Honor thy father and mother," my father said, using the trump card that always put an end to our disagreements. I crossed my arms. That's what I'm doing, I thought. That's why I'm here. But I couldn't really be sure. I was here, at least in part, because there seemed to be no other option. My father steered us onto a back road lined with maple trees on either side. The dying leaves brushed the roof of a truck, a dry rustling followed by the light thump of a tree branch. Right palm facing upward. Rotate. Repeat. Left palm facing upward. Rotate. I focused my gaze on a distant tree trunk and held on until we swept past it, until the pattern of its bark grew indistinguishable, something easily forgotten in the forest. When I was in junior high, my father took me into the beating heart of the forest to go hunting. I had pushed aside its pine branches in the quiet haze of the morning, my breath fogging beside his, our twin clouds joining for a moment in front of us, blinding us as they caught the sun. As my father tapped my shoulder to draw my attention, I raised my rifle and aimed its scope at the space beneath the shoulder of a large doe. One eye to the scope, the other winking, I watched this doe for what seemed like several minutes, though it couldn't have been for more than a few seconds. The doe appeared to me as an image of the forest itself, its wild grace effortless and unstudied, part of a natural world that didn't feel the need to question itself. It didn't seem to care if it lived or died. It simply was. Its awareness was all. The bullet I eventually fired landed somewhere in the path in front of us, missing the doe by several feet. My father spent the rest of the morning convincing me that I had hit this doe, that we were here to track its trail of blood, its thin red thread through the forest, though I knew better. I knew he was trying to comfort me. I wondered if this was how it was going to be. I would aim for something in the county jail, some truth just out of reach, perhaps behind a wall of thick black bars, and my father would spend the rest of his life trying to convince me that I'd hit the target. The deeper we descended into this labyrinth, the more lost we would become, to ourselves and to each other. Tracing everything back to where it had all begun would become impossible. Our origins, the raw materials of myths. "Have you made many good friends at college?" my father said, speeding through a yellow light. I thought of Charles and Dominique, the twin music majors who sang spirituals in the dorm lounge and asked me to watch Imitation of Life, what they described as a white-friendly intro into the black experience. "If you don't cry after watching this movie, you've got something wrong with you," Charles had said. "White people always cry with that one." Charles, Dominique, and I were quickly becoming close friends, but I was afraid of what my father would say if I described them. Though he claimed to have no problem with black people, I didn't want to bring up race when I mentioned them, didn't want to parade them around as my token black friends, didn't want to dig too deeply into my ancestors' cotton-ginning history for fear I would inherit an even greater sense of shame than I already had. There was also the fact that my college life and my home life were becoming increasingly separate entities, and after David's call to my parents, I was afraid of what other secrets might come to light if I started talking about my other life. "Most people aren't that good," I said, tapping the glass with my index finger. "You have to be discerning." Original sin was a concept my father and I knew well. I thought of my professors, and of my Western Lit class, how exhilarated I'd felt being able to discuss ideas and opinions as though they were nothing more than dirt or tiny pebbles we could sift through our fingers. I recalled how ideas that had once seemed so otherworldly and unapproachable came unglued before my eyes, lost their many associations with the angry and loving God I'd been taught so long to believe in, how they had assembled themselves into grist for other religions, other philosophies, other ways of daily living. After a few more minutes of silence, my father turned up Creedence until the music blasted my eardrums, shook the window with its bass. "I see earthquakes and lightning," Creedence sang. "I see bad times today." I slouched in my seat, propped my feet on the dash. The seatbelt locked, pinning me to the leather. I didn't talk the rest of the way. I was in my father's territory now, the Bible Belt more real to me than the one hugging my chest. At college, Dostoevsky's Underground Man still took over from time to time, inviting me to recede into the background, blend in with the furniture, observe. The only difference post-David was a deeper need to hide that sometimes overtook my days, kept me in my dorm room for so long that I would piss in discarded water bottles, tuck them under my bed, forget about them. When I later found them during one of my more sociable states, I would greet them as I would a stranger, shocked by their sudden appearance, looking back at my former self as an ugly imposter. Who would do this, I'd think. Who would be so desperate? When I learned about Freudian theory during my first semester, I grew even more concerned. This must be some unresolved childhood issue, I thought, remembering my bedroom carpet hieroglyphs. This must be another sign of my brokenness. No, suddenly switching to an Old Testament perspective, my sinfulness. There seemed to be no branch of psychology, philosophy, or literature I read that couldn't be bent to prove my guilt. By that same token, there seemed to be no idea I'd encountered that didn't complicate my understanding of Christianity, that didn't call into question my parents' God-given right to dictate my beliefs. I decided that this was what it was like to be truly insane, that only insane people clung to both sides so doggedly, refused to let them part ways, let them battle inside the mind. The trees gave way to flat grazing fields studded with cows, then to the rectangular buildings that served as the administrative center of the town, each one tethered together by the dark, cracked asphalt whose deep potholes my father's truck easily absorbed. Through the cracked window, I could smell the strong scent of manure heated by the warm morning sun, and something else. Some mixture of gasoline and rusted metal found only in farming communities, where the methods of corporate farming have advanced so ruthlessly, so rapidly, that it is necessary to devote large plots of land to junkyards and fill them with old machines stripped of valuable parts. The county jail sat on the outskirts of town, hidden behind a cluster of white-roofed buildings and a red Conoco gas station that also served as a tire and lube shop. Beside the jail stood the county courthouse, an identical building with only a few windows facing the road, last-minute additions that only temporarily relieved the uniform brick facade. I sat up to get a better look, the warm leather leaving the back of my sweaty shirt with a quiet hiss. I had been expecting barbed wire, watchtowers, rotating guards in blue uniform. I had been expecting a series of security checkpoints, each more severe than the last, some expensive Hollywood set. Instead, drawing closer to these squat buildings, I had a sense that what the town wanted most of all to hide might also receive the most traffic, since there were so many cars darting freely in and out of the parking lot. My father parked near the back, slamming the lever between us into park with the open palm of his hand. "What do you think?" he said, turning to me, the leather squeaking beneath him. "I fear rivers overflowing," Credence sang. "I hear the voice of rage and ruin." My father cut the engine, muffling Credence mid-note. "It's different than I expected," I said, looking up at the white metal roof that caught the sun at a bad angle, sent it shining directly into my eyes. It made sense, seeing it now, that people in town wouldn't want to spend all of their money on a state-of-the-art jail. They could use their taxes for keeping the beautiful things beautiful. Let the ugly things remain ugly. Allow the facility's dark brick to recede beneath the mountain-studded mecca surrounding it. I had learned by now that there was a cumulative effect to beauty. If people already saw something as beautiful, the object of their affection would continue to receive all possible praise and attention. "Rose is a rose, is a rose, is a rose," Gertrude Stein, my new favorite poet, quipped. Naming something beautiful made it so. I'd seen this in the way the church spoke of marriage as a sacred institution, and in the one man plus one woman bumper stickers people sported on their vehicles, the same ones my father would hand to any customer passing through his dealership service department. Naming something ugly had a similar effect. The sound of my mother's vomiting the night she drove me home had taught me this lesson better than anything else ever had. I was gay, had been named as such, a fact that, once ingested, had to be immediately expelled. My father and I sat in silence for a few more seconds. "We're not going to talk about your situation anymore," he said. "Not until we know something else." I wondered if my parents had already arranged a therapy session, if they were just waiting to tell me after the jail. As irrational as it seemed to me even at the time, I thought of my visit here as a test of my conviction, of my courage, of the love I felt for my family. Without missing a beat, my father opened the console between us and pulled out a jumbo bag of peanut M&Ms. It seemed magical, this gesture. 1 second before, there had been only brown leather and the dark plastic of the dashboard and the dark colors of our clothes. And now here there was this bright yellow bag of hard candy reflecting the morning light in my father's hands. "Catch," he said, tossing the bag in my direction. My hands fumbled, botching the catch, the bag landing in my lap to the sound of 100 tiny marbles clacking at once. "What is this?" I said. "M&Ms." I juggled the bright yellow bag between my hands. "I'm just wondering why you have them." "Here's what you'll do," my father said, opening the driver's side door, a gust of unseasonably warm air filling our cabin. "You'll give a handful of M&Ms to any inmate who can recite at least 2 Bible verses." "That's the plan?" I asked. "Candy?" "A few pieces of candy might seem like nothing to you, but these inmates don't have much. They love it when I visit." Church congregants often said my father's plans were inspired, and for good reason. They almost always came out of left field, caught you unawares, were just close enough to the point of absurdity to provide a little thrill in the pit of the stomach, made you question what could possibly happen next. Though I felt I'd outgrown them by now, I had to admit that my father's tactics often spawned from his own peculiar brand of genius. He understood what people wanted most of all, and he learned how to build his mission work around it. Even though I hadn't asked him, I could already guess my father's logic. Give the inmates something they craved, something to work toward all week, and then lead them into a deeper understanding of Scripture, their bodies giving way to their souls. It was a variation on what Jesus had performed near Bethsaida, transforming 7 loaves of bread and a few fish into enough food to feed 5,000 men. My father's miracle would be, like Jesus's, one of magnification. A few peanut M&Ms planted like a seed in these men's bellies, and they would feel satisfied by the shock of the nearly forgotten taste. Then, only then, would they be prepared to receive the body of Christ. This was a reward system that had worked for me when I was younger. At Vacation Bible School, I would recite the books of the Bible in order, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, the names strange and weighty on my tongue, conjuring up images of dusty scrolls and old bearded men sitting on gilded thrones. I had learned as many names as I could, knowing that our pastor would later reward me with candy. "Suffer little children," the Bible says. I had heard my father explain once that the inmates were in many ways like little children caught with their hands in various candy jars, and that we were all like little children, lost until we found Jesus. Now we would teach the inmates that the rewards of candy, and eventually of heaven, came only after due diligence. "We have to appeal to their lower natures," my father said, "before we can appeal to their higher ones." This past year, my father had learned not to give the inmates anything that wasn't mass-produced. He later told me that he had once filled a water cooler with grapes and ice and passed out dripping bunches to the bars, only to find out later that the men had tried to make hooch, filling Ziploc bags with juice from his grapes and putting pieces of stale bread into them, tucking the bags under their bunks to ferment. Lying in bed at night, I would imagine these men gathered around the little bags, whispering gently and caressing the cool plastic with their calloused fingers. I would imagine all of them with tattooed arms wrapped around one another's shoulders, acting soft and sweet when no one was looking. I would imagine joining them behind the bars, slipping into one of the bunks, gripping the plastic underbelly, and sipping their warm wine. Then, the moment the guilt began to flood my chest and my breathing grew shallow, I would erase the thought, close my eyes so tightly that orange spots began to crowd my vision. The images would then dim, fade behind a wall of swirling dots, no longer beautiful to me. Before agreeing to come to the jail, I hadn't asked my father anything about what went on inside. I only knew that I needed to follow him, give him and God my best shot, do the things that might make me worthy in both of their eyes. At the age of 9, while watching the Disney version of Peter Pan, I had sat transfixed before the living room television as Peter shook his shadow out to dry, and it was to this sense of awe that I needed to return at the age of 18, to become a shadow, stitch myself to the soles of my father's feet until there was no longer any danger of being lost or trodden upon. I had already grown so much in that first semester of college, I had already been through so much that the thought of returning to eternal youth, of becoming a child once again in God's eyes, seemed an impossible act. I had flown to a new territory, but unlike what happened to Peter, this territory had altered me completely, rendered me somewhat of a stranger in my own home. I imagined this was how David's boy had felt just after the rape, a stranger to himself and others around him, and I wondered if, and hoped that, he had found someone to lead him out of the maze where David had ravaged and left him. In my unconscious, this unnamed boy had somehow become Brandon. I had nightmares about it. Moments of transfiguration in which the boy would stand up from a pile of soiled sheets and walk across Chloe's basement floor to the edge of my sleeping bag. The slapping of feet on cold concrete. And in the blue light of the television, his features would become Brandon's, and he would ask me if I truly wanted to be gay. And when I didn't answer, he would ask me if I truly wanted to kill myself. And when I didn't answer again, he would lie beside me on the sleeping bag, stare white-eyed into my eyes like Janet Leigh in Psycho until the dream ended. Despite this dream, I hadn't called Brandon to check up on him, too terrified of hearing something I didn't want to hear, too unprepared for whatever Chloe might say if she answered the phone. I still hadn't spoken to Chloe since cutting off communication, and I didn't want to face her judgment once she found out what I was going through. How could I begin to explain to her a situation that, for all intents and purposes, didn't exist? On the ride to jail, I had braced myself for David's sudden appearance each time our truck hugged a curve in the road. I knew it was irrational, that there was no reason for David to be on these roads, but just the mention of his name had the power to conjure him. I had examined each vehicle we passed for traces of his pale face, darting my eyes quickly from one passenger to the next so I wouldn't have to endure prolonged eye contact. Considering my current situation, however, the county jail seemed like the safest place to avoid him. I had already learned that no one was going to punish him for what he did. Our Presbyterian college's pastor had counseled me to keep my head down, avoid scandal, since it would only be my word against his. Keeping my head down was something David taught me best of all. But it was the others, the ones whom I later told, who insisted on a permanent spinal readjustment. What David had done to this boy and me was invisible, something people around me simply didn't want to discuss. In taking on the power of invisibility, I had also given up my voice. "Don't be scared," my father said, eyeing me. "These men are just like everyone else. They just got caught." We both stepped out of the truck. I held the bag of M&Ms in a tight grip. "I'm not scared," I said, my syllables cracking open. "Scared." My father clicked the remote on his keys and the truck honked beside me, flashing its useless headlights. He had dressed down for the occasion, standing in pale jeans and white tennis shoes and an untucked dark blue button-down, his graying black hair tousled by the occasional breeze that slipped between the mountains behind us. Since many of the inmates inside were poor and down on their luck, he didn't want to wear anything too expensive and give them the wrong impression. He wasn't Jim Baker. He didn't want their money. He wanted their souls safe and secure in heaven. I stood beside him in a black Legend of Zelda t-shirt, frayed denim jeans, and flip-flops. I'd rediscovered the t-shirt the night before in the bottom of my old dresser, after the 2-hour drive home from college. Though I hadn't touched a video game in over a year, Zelda seemed an appropriate choice. Link, the game's silent protagonist, was an expert at entering dungeons and solving puzzles. I needed him now more than ever. I followed my father across the black asphalt. We stepped into the partial shade of the jail, and he rotated his silver watch until its glass face glinted up at him, burned a white half-moon onto his cheek. "Wild Thing should be here by now," he said, the half-moon sliding between the cleft of his chin. Wild Thing was my father's nickname for Jeff, a man who washed cars for him full-time, and one of the members of my father's prayer circle. I had worked alongside him every summer since my father took over the dealership, had learned how to detail cars from him. He taught me to notice the smallest blemishes in used cars, the dusty space between the speedometer's face and its glass cover, the crumb-filled margins between the front seats and the console, the gooey inner linings of backseat storage pockets. He taught me that details were what mattered most. People wanted to believe that someone was paying attention, that someone cared enough to dig deep. When my father first met him, Wild Thing's hair had been long and greasy, slicked back like a rodent's, and his words had run together in one long slur. After my father led Wild Thing to the Lord, kneeling with him in his office, the name had stuck as a sort of ironic misnomer. Wild Thing was hardly wild anymore. We had made a good team. When we worked together, he took to the chemicals while I took to the pressure washer. When we encountered an impossible stain, both of us took turns scrubbing it with a rag, picking up where the other left off. Unlike me, however, Wild Thing had been able to give himself a detailing. He used his skills to tame whatever past he'd had. He'd found a way out of the darkness, gotten a haircut, covered up his tattoos with long sleeves, learned how to enunciate his syllables, and it led him to teach these inmates to follow the same path. He showed up a few minutes later, his short hair slicked to one side with a generous amount of product. "Sorry I'm late," he said, his breathing shallow, his face sweaty. "Had to go back for my Bible." He held up a black King James Bible, fanned it back and forth in front of his face. He never went anywhere without it. A new Christian hungry for the Word of God, as my father put it. As far as I could tell, he knew nothing of my situation. My father seemed to confirm this with a look that said, "You might be here because of your sin, but you don't need to acknowledge it. You don't need to let anyone else know our shame." "God didn't waste any time this morning," Wild Thing said, craning his neck to look at the sky, his Adam's apple bobbing. "Turned out to be a beautiful day." I followed his gaze. A raft of cirrus clouds was breaking apart above the mountain peaks, tumbling lazily through the troposphere. It was one of those days when the blackness of space seems to press harder against the atmosphere, lending the sky a richer saturation, unnoticed until the eye chooses to reveal its depth. "That's the sight of God resting," my father said. "And he rested on the seventh day." "We don't get to rest," Wild Thing said, gesturing to the jail entrance. "God made this world, and now we've got to make sure we don't ruin it with our sin." The three of us walked up to the jail's metal door. My father pressed a small red button in the center of a metal box and announced himself. He turned back to us, clearing his throat. "Ready to save some souls?" he said. "Been waiting all morning," Wild Thing said. From somewhere above our heads came the sound of a mounted camera revolving to face us. The three of us looked up, watched its lens zoom. From that high angle, our faces must have formed a triangle, with mine as the rear vertex. The door hummed to life, the sound of a game show buzzer. My father pushed open the door. I followed him and Wild Thing inside the anteroom, the shock of air conditioning on my skin, and waited for the other door to buzz open. We stood in a cramped metal box, as though in an elevator, with a small window looking out into an empty reception area. "Just so we're all on the same page," my father said, his voice a sudden echo. "What's the only verse the inmates can't get any candy for?" I squared my shoulders. This time I didn't hesitate to guess. John 11:35. It was a verse every devout missionary Baptist kid had tried memorizing at least once, usually when first asked to recite something in vacation Bible school, and usually because it was so short. My father didn't want the inmates to slack on reading their Bibles by studying such a simple verse. He wanted as many of God's words to enter their heads as possible. Jesus wept. Two simple words that had haunted me. I hadn't cried since the night my mother drove me back from campus, since I had watched the high-line wires dip between the pale stars, thinking only of what my father would say once he found out, the wires stringing together constellations I couldn't name. I didn't plan to cry again anytime soon. When I saw a man crying in church, it seemed as though he were about to rip the skin from his face, peel it back for everyone to see his second, secret self. In the weeks following my rape, any time I thought about crying, I pinched myself hard enough to focus on the pain instead. I wasn't about to give anyone another opportunity to see my weakness. My father turned to me, his hazel eyes flashing green in the fluorescence. The door buzzed open in front of us, but he didn't move. "That's right," he said, raising his hand to clap me on the back. I flinched involuntarily, and his hand froze. "Right," he repeated, opening the door. Wild Thing and I walked with him up to the front desk. A police officer with a half-chewed cigar sticking out of one corner of his mouth nodded at us and buzzed us into the next door. This was a small jail in a small Ozark town, so the jailers knew my father well. No need to present ID, no need for a frisking. "Make sure to stay at least 5 feet away from the cells," my father said, and don't listen if some of them cuss at you." He motioned for me to enter first. I nodded. I wanted to prove that I was as brave as he. I wanted to prove that I could change. Open the doors and see all the people. The hallway inside was dark. It was dark, but this could have been simply because we had just stepped out of the sun. Neon spots swirled in an arc across my path, popped along the edges of the dim cells. Phosphenes, my high school biology teacher called them when I fell asleep in her class. "Did you enjoy your visit with the phosphenes?" The night David forced me to his bed, I had seen hundreds of them. Pink and yellow and orange swirls gliding like figure skaters beneath my eyelids. "Sometimes this is referred to as prisoner's cinema," the biology teacher continued. "A phenomenon that was associated with staring at blank walls for hours. In my case, staring at my blank bedroom wall with a pair of scissors in hand, hoping a solution would present itself, that God would write the answer with his disembodied hand, as he had for King Belshazzar in the Old Testament." I kept to the wall, my shoulder dipping in and out of the gaps between its white concrete blocks. Occasionally, I could make out the pale flash of a smiling face striped with dark metal bars. None of the inmates seemed to stir. None of them said a word except for the occasional hello or nice to see you. I kept my candy-filled hands away from them, afraid they might lunge through the bars, though they all seemed overly polite. I could hear my father's footsteps echoing behind me, but I didn't turn back, afraid he would detect fear in my eyes. The previous weekend, when I'd visited him at the dealership, my father had raised his fist to strike me, a moment when our mutual fear of my sexuality first met. I'd made some kind of joke in the showroom while everyone was watching, something about him not wanting to seem weak in front of his customers, something I hadn't been able to recall the minute he brought me into his office and threatened me with his fist. In the next moment, his face had filled with terror at the recognition of what he was doing, what his father had once done to him, and he relaxed his fist, apologizing, looking down at the carpet the whole time. "Do it," I thought. "Do it, and I'll have a free pass. Do it, and I don't have to love you anymore." But he hadn't done anything. A tear formed in the corner of his eye, ran down his cheek to the spot between the cleft of his chin, and that was it. Whether the tear was for his gay son or for himself, I couldn't say. I was mostly thankful he hadn't begun to weep. "We'll figure something out," he'd said, his voice trembling. "We'll get you to a specialist." I reminded myself that he wouldn't knowingly lead me into danger, that despite everything, he had chosen to relax his fist, and I relaxed a little in that dark hallway. My father was the one person in a crowd you could rely on to respond immediately if an emergency popped up. When I was younger, he would survey every carnival ride at the county fair before I was allowed to ride any of them. As I swung by him on the rotating swing, my legs kicking up, the summer air tickling the backs of my knees, I would see his serious face as a fixed point in the turning world, his eyes fastened to the bolt above my head. He seemed always to be right behind me, watching over me. College had made me stray from him, from his and the church's teachings, and I had been severely punished. The bolt had come unfastened, and I had plummeted to the spot where David could easily pin me down. "Excuse me," the cigar-chewing policeman said, moving past me. He spat clumps of tobacco into a styrofoam cup in his hand. Catapulting from his lips, they looked like tiny dark pieces of confetti. In his other hand, he carried a large brass key ring filled with what looked like hundreds of keys. His fingers sped through several keys until he found the right one and plugged it into the door at the end of the hallway, jerking open the lock. "Wait here," my father said, moving past me, heading inside with the policeman to an area where a large group of inmates awaited us in one large cell. The officer and my father were going ahead of Wild Thing and me to ensure that everything was in order for the service. Each time my father visited the inmates, he had to spend at least 10 minutes calming them first, asking them to turn down the mounted television in the corner of the cell, to stop cussing at one another. Through the open door, I could also make out the women's cell block at the other end of the large room, the figures of several older women moving away from the bars as my father passed, embarrassed grimaces overtaking their faces, strands of long hair falling limply over their shoulders. "Your old man used to preach to those women, too," Wild Thing said, leaning against the wall. The door groaned shut in front of us, followed by the sound of its latch sliding into the faceplate. "What happened?" I said. "Why'd he stop?" "They started getting too nasty," he said. They offered him favors, if you know what I mean. You don't know what it feels like to be with a woman. What did he do about it? I said. You know how your dad can be, Wild Thing said, eyeing the cell across from us. The man inside didn't seem to be listening. He was lying on his back, his features concealed by the forearm he'd draped across his face. As I later discovered, this hallway was reserved for some of the more extreme cases. He tried even harder after that, Wild Thing continued. Preached better than I'd ever heard him preach. Did he change them? Wild Thing shook his head. The things those women said to him after that, he said. I can't repeat it in good conscience. I wondered when my father had told this to Wild Thing. Had they exchanged looks of momentary bliss, stories of the women they'd been with, of near misses that had almost resulted in a fall from grace? The one time my father took me to Hooters, around the time I hit puberty, I had been so obsequious to the waitresses, looking down at their shoes the whole time, that he must have mistaken this for a foot fetish. There are plenty of parts to admire on a woman, he'd said, as if we were talking about nothing more than his hot rods. We'd never gone back. He finally quit, though, Wild Thing said. Sometimes there's just no curing people. Months later, in a gesture that would shock our church, my father would receive permission from the jail to marry two of the inmates who had known each other before incarceration, proving that he could still reach the women in some capacity, that this sacred ceremony might lead some of them to the straight path. He would stand with his back to a large maple tree, recite 1 Corinthians, love is patient, love is kind, allow the other inmates to throw a short reception in the big cell, and arrange for a conjugal visit that night. Marriage knows no boundaries, the gesture seemed to suggest, so long as it is sanctified in God's eyes. The ceremony would earn him even more respect than he already had, inspiring many female inmates to kneel on their concrete cell floors and ask Jesus into their hearts. Wild Thing dug his hand into the back pocket of his jeans. When he pulled it out again, he was holding several multicolored tracts. He held out a stack for me. Now we just hand the women a stack of these and hope they learn something from Christ's message. I tucked the bag of M&Ms under one arm, took the stack, and thumbed through the thick pages, the bright red and gold Comic Sans typeface glinting up at me in the dim light. I flipped through to the end of a booklet, to a watercolor illustration of a heavenly mansion with one large street of glittering gold stretching out in a straight path in front of it. There is only one way to enter the kingdom of heaven, the booklet read. J-E-S-U-S. I had seen these tracts lying around our house each time I came home, more and more of them littering our counters, our tables, the seats of our chairs. When I would leave again for college, my father would urge me to take a few just in case I found the chance to minister to a lost college student. The most I had ever done was leave a few of these tracts on top of a toilet paper dispenser in the library bathroom. Exiting the stall, however, I'd imagined strangers slipping through these pages, their fingerprints melding with mine. It had given me a thrill to know that this would occur at their most vulnerable moments, jeans bunched around their ankles. Like my father, I knew something about temptation. It seemed the best option in those cases was to toss the tracts and keep walking. Given enough time, a solution might present itself. You know what? Wild Thing said, running a hand through his phantom hair, forgetting, like always, that a tangled, greasy mess no longer covered his head. We should hand out some of these tracts while we're waiting for your dad. That sounds good, I said, pocketing the tracts. The words felt hollow, but I was committed. Good, Wild Thing echoed. We can head in opposite directions, talk to a few men, and meet back here. Good, I said. He turned away. His faith in me was instant. I was my father's son. The path had been rolled out right before my feet, unfurling all the way to the edge of God's gilded throne. Wild Thing must have believed that I was the lucky one, skipping so many steps. I watched him walk down the hallway in the direction of the entrance. He headed down an adjoining hallway, and I was left alone. I flipped back to the beginning of the tract. Are you lost? It read. There was a drawing of a small brown-haired boy standing in the middle of a poorly lit street. Leaning on a lamppost in the distance was a dark-cloaked figure. Satan himself, cartoonishly evil, with a crooked cane and a sharp red tail sliding out from the back of his cloak. Despite his menace, Satan looked lonely, standing there by himself in his isolated patch of darkness. There had been only one year when I hadn't felt alone. I was 12 years old, a time when missionary Baptists would say I was born again, the moment in every true believer's life when you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior and vow to be a Christian for the rest of your life. Though the feeling had waned since I was a young child, I could still feel God's all-encompassing love emanating from some deep shelf behind my solar plexus. The feeling mounted itself there on a night when I was lying in my bottom bunk and feeling as though I didn't deserve to live. This was after our preacher gave a fiery sermon about how Christians must humble themselves before the Lord, how we must realize how wicked and small we are the minute we leave our mother's womb. That night, within the empty echo chamber of my mind, a place usually reserved for the petty considerations of the day, I asked, "Am I loved?" The answer came in the form of a physical burning that traveled through my whole body, sent my limbs trembling. In that instant, I loved the feel of the sheets on my back. I loved the way the bedroom carpet felt cool beneath my toes when I stood up. I loved every face I had ever seen, every blemish and worry line. I covered my face in my hands and wept for joy. In asking for love, I had given it to myself and others. And at the time, I believed that God had lent me this capacity. As I grew older, however, and as love came to me less easily, I began to wonder if that feeling wasn't all just a hallucination. After all, this had been an untested love. Love, over time, could either blossom or wither, become a source of wonder or a remembered ache. I looked up to see the inmate across from me sitting upright in his bunk. He was watching me. He must have been listening to us the whole time. He was older, with gray hair cuffing his ears. Half-moon worry lines etched the skin around his eyes, and his long arms fell between his knees like limp vines. "Hello," I said. "What's your name?" The man nodded, his eyes still watching me. I tried not to follow the length of his arms, tried not to look at the slight slope of a bulge between his legs. It was all too familiar, with him sitting on the bunk that way. I felt something overturn inside my chest, some hidden pocket of rage I'd previously forgotten. "Where are you from?" I said. It was a stupid question. The inmates were all locals. Most of them had been born and raised in this town. The man coughed, blinking.
"What do you have there?"
he said, his voice a dry rattle.
"Candy?"
"Yes," I said, holding the bag of M&Ms in front of me. The tiny marbles shifted to one side. "But I have these, too." I reached inside my pants pocket and pulled out a wrinkled batch of tracts, stepping closer, holding them out for the man to examine. I didn't touch the bars, afraid they might crumble at the slightest pressure. He looked from my hands to my face, from one to the other, as if trying to decide which was more dangerous. A look of fear passed between us. As his eyes watched me, I thought of all the doors that kept this man from seeing the view of the Ozarks outside, from seeing the way the fog lifted over the peaks each morning in pink ribbons. It was no wonder my father's tracts worked so well, their bright streets a stylized dream of the world outside.
"I know what those are," the man finally said. "Your dad's been trying to hand me one for ages."
"Oh," I said. I looked away, my gaze circling once again to the bunk. I couldn't help it.
"Your dad's funny about those things," he said.
There was a slight pause.
"If I took one, would you give me those M&Ms?
My eyes adjusted to the dim. I could just begin to make out the man's weak attempt at decorating his cell, a few magenta crayon drawings on the wall from what looked like the hand of a child, a faded calendar open to the wrong month, a stack of letters on the corner of his desk. Unlike the large men's cell where my father and I would be handing out candy, there was no television here to distract him. Perhaps he had done something violent. Perhaps he had killed a man, assaulted a woman. "If you can recite two Bible verses," I said, "I'll give you a handful." The worry lines of the man's face grew more pronounced, his eyes receding deep behind his furrowed brow.
"I don't have a Bible," he said.
"My dad probably has one in the next room," I said. "I can get you one real quick, and then you can find two short verses. It'll be easy."
"What if I told you I couldn't read?"
I looked at the stack of letters on his desk. Did he have someone to read to him, or was he simply telling a lie he couldn't be bothered to conceal? "Maybe I could read them to you," I said, "and you could repeat them.
What if I told you I have a bad memory?
My throat tightened. I closed my eyes.
Left palm facing out. Breathe. Turn the left hand in.
The man continued to watch me from his bunk.
Breathe.
All I had to do was hand this man a tract and walk away. It was the least I could do.
Do not say to yourself, turn the left hand. Awareness is all.
Why don't you just take one of these tracts, I said, and we can talk again next week?
No, the man said.
The word was harder than the steel between us. I didn't press him further. That was the best I could do. When my father returned a few minutes later, I would hide my failure behind a smile. There were details I would sometimes forget about the night of my father's ultimatum. The memory would dissolve, and then it would return at unexpected moments. Waiting in the jail hallway for my father to come back, tracts glued to my sweaty hand as I stared at a patch of bare concrete above the exit, I remembered the worst moment from that night. It had been sometime after midnight. I was on my way to the kitchen for a glass of water. I had paused before the sliver of lamplight between the door frame and the door of my father's bedroom.
What about the doctor?
My mother had whispered, her hand cupping the cordless phone receiver. My father sat next to her on the edge of the bed, watching the carpet. I had no idea who might be on the other end of the line, whom they might be talking to about me.
Do you think it could be hormones?
My mother said.
It can't be hormones, my father said. The boy doesn't need a doctor. All he needs is to read the Bible more.
How do you know? My mother asked, covering the receiver. How do you know what he needs? Maybe he needs a doctor.
My mother looked up at that moment. I couldn't tell if she saw me, but she scooted over on the bed out of my line of sight.
I walked into the kitchen, stared up at the half moon just outside the window, at its reflection gliding along the softly rippling lake, unprepared for whatever lay ahead. After the jail, after walking away from the unbeliever and wandering the hallways with my unopened bag of M&Ms, I began to look forward to the mysterious doctor I'd overheard my parents talking about. Though I had no idea what this doctor might do for me, and though I didn't ask my parents if they had scheduled an appointment, I hoped this exam might be easier than the ones that had come before. I began to look forward to the idea of a needle pricking my skin, to blood funneling into labeled vials, to anything concrete that might tell me what was wrong with me or why I couldn't perform what seemed to me then the simplest of tasks, a humble exchange from one hand to another, the passage of Jesus's word between two people. Maybe my mother had been right. Maybe something was off about my hormones. Maybe my hormones made me less of a man. I had failed my father's test at the jail, though he hadn't even questioned me about the tracts, though I wasn't certain either one of us even knew what a passing grade might resemble. Perhaps it would look something like Wild Thing's smiling face when he came back empty-handed, yet armed with stories of the men who courteously took his tracts into their hands, said they'd read the words before his next visit. I didn't know anything more now than I had before my visit to the jail. A week passed. My parents visited with Brother Stevens while I was away at college, discussing whether or not there might be a cure for my condition. He knew surprisingly little about how Love in Action operated, but seemed to think that this was the best organization of its kind. An ex-gay umbrella group, Exodus International, had recommended it to him, and with a strong endorsement from the fundamentalist Christian group Focus on the Family, my parents were sold. LIA was the oldest and largest residential ex-gay therapy facility in the country. If they couldn't turn me straight, no one could. In order to prepare for ex-gay therapy, LIA wanted me to attend some intro sessions with a staff-approved therapist. My mother drove me to Memphis at the beginning of Thanksgiving break to attend one of these sessions. The therapist's office was adjacent to LIA, but we weren't allowed to go inside LIA's facility until I had completed an application process that would take months for final approval. Inside the counselor's office, I confessed what I would later learn was my first moral inventory, detailing my same-sex attractions in a vague, desexualized language, leaving out all the stuff about David, but including as many sexual fantasies as I could recall. When the counselor asked me if I'd had any relationships, I told him about Chloe, about how guilty I'd felt lying to her through omission.
She might have helped you through your struggle, the counselor said. If you'd told her the truth and both of you had confessed before God, you might have found a future together.
I couldn't say anything in response. I wanted to tell him about the pressure I'd felt, about how Chloe and I had almost had sex in order to cure my condition, but I was afraid he'd just tell me more about what I'd done wrong. I grew quiet, and the counselor used this as an opportunity to preach about the need for true repentance. When our hour was up, my mother asked if she could speak to him alone, and when she came out of the office, her eyes were watery and red. I knew he told her something, and this something had finally convinced her. Once we were inside the car, she said, "We're going to take it one step at a time. We're going to try every option." We were silent the rest of the way home. The Sunday before Thanksgiving break ended, my father was in a rare mood. It was late in the morning, but he was still sitting in his leather recliner, wearing camouflage boxers and a white V-necked t-shirt, one pale leg propped on the glass coffee table. His eyes were trained on the television, where a young Clint Eastwood narrowed his crow's feet eyes at a desert landscape and prepared to set off into the unknown. Always the sharpshooter, Clint never missed his mark. You could see it in his eyes. I brushed past my father to grab my car keys on the table. Even though I no longer had to work the projector, I often left early to clear my head before the service. "He's not afraid of anything," my father said. "What?" "Clint," he said. "He walks right into the line of fire." At the jail 2 weeks earlier, my father had preached about the importance of courage. Real men, he said, weren't afraid to show emotion. Real men followed Jesus. As I sat beside him, passing out the M&Ms to the bars, I had thought, Jesus wept. The one verse he told them not to memorize, even though it would have fit in so nicely with his sermon. Such a simple, compact verse at first glance, but one every bit as difficult to interpret as any other. "We should know something about the doctor this week," he said. "Don't worry." I headed into the kitchen to find my mother sweeping a patch of tile near the door. "Hi, honey," she said. "You go on ahead." I couldn't leave without asking her what my father had meant about the doctor. "What will we know," I said, "at the end of this week?" She looked up from her sweeping. "Dr. Julie's going to give you some tests over Christmas break," she said. "Something to do with testosterone levels. And then we'll move from there." Dr. Julie, our family doctor, was a woman I'd visited for the past 5 years. She always knew how to make me feel comfortable when she read over my charts, casually reciting her litany of cause and effect. I felt better knowing that this something would at least be performed by her. I left the house that morning in a stupor. I hardly noticed when my parents entered the church. I hardly heard a word of Brother Stevens's message. And when I drove back to college that afternoon, my stomach full of roast and mashed potatoes and gravy from the church potluck, the Ozarks sinking into flatland on either side, I almost didn't notice the auburn-colored blur that edged its way to the line of pines, slipping past my periphery like a spot of dark light. I didn't brace myself, but the impact never came. Only a second before, the doe would have sent me spinning into the sharp granite wall flanking the road. Still, the afterimage remained. The hesitant doe, 1 foot hovering above the unkind asphalt, a stray drifting from her natural habitat, afraid of where her steps had taken her. 2. Outside the context of a political war between faith and reason, more nuanced arrangements may be safely undertaken. Jennifer Michael Hecht. Doubt. Rules are empty in themselves, violent and unfinalized. They are impersonal and can be bent to any purpose. The successes of history belong to those who are capable of seizing these rules, to replace those who have used them, to disguise themselves so as to perfect them, invert their meaning, and redirect them against those who had initially imposed them. Michel Foucault, Language, Countermemory, Practice. The Smallest Details. Thanksgiving break had ended. I had gone back to college, and my mother had been washing dishes all afternoon. The mail had just arrived, but she was too afraid to sort through the stack. Thanks to a phone call Brother Stevens had made on my parents' behalf, she and my father had been expecting a reply from Love in Action any day now. They had also scheduled an appointment for me with Dr. Julie over Christmas break to test my testosterone levels. They were taking all possible steps to cure me, but my mother felt that everything was moving too quickly. Only a few months ago, she hadn't even known anything was wrong. Half a year ago, it had seemed her only son had found the girl of his dreams.